All right, good morning. Be good to see you. Let's turn our Bibles to Luke chapter 9. And we'll begin our study in verse 37. Luke 9. I hadn't even got to talk to Teresa this morning, so I haven't talked at all. You know, so. Yeah. So we're on separate tracks this morning. That was the way it was. All right. So good to see you. Luke chapter 9. We have been noticing up to this point quite an emphasis by Luke on who Jesus is. And as I mentioned last week, there is now a transition as he still is talking about obviously who Jesus is, but now who do the disciples have to be? And the rest of chapter 9 and even following, there's going to be a lot of emphasis on what discipleship is about. You can imagine Theophilus now at this point learning what it's really going to take to follow Jesus, which makes this a really interesting and important section here. All right. So let's take a look at 37 down through verse 43 here. They have just come down. Remember, Peter, James, and John and Jesus have just come down from the mountain after Jesus has been transfigured. And so this is the setup for verse 37. Let's begin with prayer. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for a blessing of being able to rise and know that you are there and to worship you. Thank you so much for these words that you have delivered to us to know your mind, and know your character. Please help us to become like you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, let's read verse 37. On the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met them. And behold, a man from the crowd cried out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him and will hardly leave him. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And all were astonished at the majesty of God. All right, I know that section sounds like it's talking about primarily about the greatness of Jesus and who Jesus is, but he's beginning to show us something deeper than that. Okay, so he comes down from the mountain, a great crowd's waiting for them. We know from Matthew's account that there's quite a disturbance going on. People, the crowd is not happy. They are accusatory, etc. And Luke doesn't bother with that particular part, but the crowd just all of a sudden simply comes and begins to attack Jesus almost verbally about what is happening as far as this spirit not being able to be cast out by the apostles. All right, so anyway, you see all the things about the spirit. We've talked about spirit and demon possession before. Might just stop and go, what's your key passage in the Old Testament that says the unclean spirit would be removed from the land? Haven't drilled you on that one, have I? Yeah. Zechariah 13, verses 1 and 2, reads easier than in any translation except the ESV. ESV doesn't have a great translation on that. What's the matter? What's the matter with you two right here? Did I not hear something? Did I not hear you say something? Okay. all right, so the unclean spirit be cast out of the land, false prophets be cast out of the land is in the same text. Are the prophets to be cast out of land? Is the idea of the text? No more prophecy from people. All right, so that is the key. Now, here's the big question that you're going to have to answer when you are going to teach somebody this, and that is when Jesus answers in verse 41, and calls them a faithless and twisted generation. How long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here. Who is he talking about?
It seems to be talking about his disciples not being able to cast out the spirit.
Yeah, pretty strong words for them, isn't it? Got confirmation for that? Here's confirmation for it. Take a look at Matthew chapter 17, verse 20. Matthew 17, verse 20, same incident. All right, and we'll start at verse 17 in Matthew 17. Jesus answered, twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. Jesus rebuked this demon. It came out. The boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? And he said, because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have the faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. So he is rebuking their lack of faith in casting this demon out. You think of a parallel in the Old Testament, parallel to God telling Israel to do something and told them they were able to do it, and then they couldn't do it. Going into the promised land. That's exactly right. He told them in the book of Joshua, when you go in, I don't care if they have chariots of iron. I don't care what they have. You will be able to conquer them. You will be able to take them out. And you get to Judges chapter 1, and the scripture says that, well, they couldn't drive them out because they had chariots of iron. And over and over again, they couldn't. Yeah, they could, but they didn't have faith. And then in Judges 2, an angel appears to them and rebukes them for not driving the enemies out of the land. The rebuke was their lack of faith. They were so scared, they just couldn't do it. You get an idea. So when you look at this text, what do you think intimidated the apostles to make them not have that faith that they needed? Yo.
I think they couldn't visualize them doing it. They could visualize Jesus doing it. But when you're thoroughly convicted that something's going to happen and you can make it happen, you see it before it happens. But I think they just doubted their own ability.
Yeah, okay. Now, they have done it before. Remember, earlier chapters, they came back from the limited commission that they were sent out on, and they rejoiced that they had cast out demons. And so it was not like they hadn't done it before. There's something different about this one. Yo, Brian.
Well, in the account of Matthew, the very next verse is, however, this time does not go out except by prayer and fasting. They were praying.
Okay. And notice the words, this kind. This apparently is this not an ordinary demon, run-of-the-mill demon. Okay, now you're talking to somebody who doesn't know much about this, and what might you explain here about these spirits and demons that we know, again, from the Old Testament?
Apparently they had different rankings in their...
They have different powers. That's right. They have different powers, and some are extremely strong. Do you remember an incident like that where a good angel was weaker than a bad angel in the Old Testament? Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10. You have a good spirit who came to give the answer to Daniel's prayer. And it took him 3 weeks to get there, remember? It took him 3 weeks to get there. When he got there, he's like, I've been trying, Daniel, I've been trying. I left 3 weeks ago, and the prince of the kingdom of Persia has withheld me. And it took the chief prince to come and release me from the prince of the kingdom of Persia. And now that I'm done here telling you this, I got to go back and battle with him because the prince of the kingdom of Greece is coming too, 300 years later. Is that a weird realm? It's just that, whew, what's going on around us? What's going on up there? Yeah, there's different. Each angels have different strengths and powers. The evil demons that, of course, probably just fallen angels have different strengths and powers. And so this one is extremely powerful. And you can see when Jesus approached and he's bringing his son, what does the demon do? He just thrashes the kid. He just... It's like, you're not intimidating Jesus, though. Jesus says, get out. That's the end of it. So you see this, what message of discipleship are you learning here? Right off. Pretty obvious message, right? To follow Jesus, you're going to have to trust him and his strength and his power, and trust that you can conquer the most difficult sins, the most difficult situations. I don't care what it is, you can conquer. And it's that lack of faith that causes us to fail. We have to put our strength and faith in him. Isn't there a passage in James that talks about this, that Adam has talked about in James chapter 1? If you pray and you do not believe, fat chance you're going to get an answer. That's the way it is. Julie.
The other thing I thought about was the importance of serving
yourself. Good. Yeah, and Brian read that into that text. This kind does not come out without fasting and prayer. Very, very good. So it takes that confidence. And you know, you don't get confidence in God by just ginning up your own, okay, have confidence in God. You get confidence in God, how? You gotta learn about him. You gotta really go back and look at all those times. Look at the history of God. Does he fail? No. The only time his people fail is when they fail to trust him. And Israel and Canaan is a great example that way.
You know, when Jesus did great miracles, he always asked his Father. It's not like he said, okay, I'm going to do this. He was a good example, probably, of what they didn't do. They might have thought, oh, we can do this without
asking. Yeah, again, anytime faith wanes is because you're looking at yourself and not looking at God. That's exactly right. By the way, you know, Wayne and Debbie, you guys have been backsliding. You know, it's used to sit up here, and now I can't get used to that. You know, I just okay. I had to say that. Sorry. Okay. So anyway, you see that great emphasis here. If you're going to be one of Jesus' disciples, here's a great example of what it's going to take. You're going to run into huge obstacles. Mark does this a lot in sequence in his letter, doing different things. But in fact, there's been books written. I haven't read any of them. I ought to. There's been books written about the training of the 12. And we need to never forget that during this time, Jesus is training the 12, but at the same time, he's giving us pictures of how we are to be trained as well. Okay? Any other thoughts about this incident? Yeah.
I also think it illustrates that our state should not be, we should not look at it right. I'm either a follower of Christ and I believe what he says and that's it, like I'm done. You flip a switch and you're a follower and you're done. Or your switch isn't flipped and you're not a follower and you're off. The disciples were followers. They were faithful, sufficient, that they were able to cast out demons. And then they come across some that they can't. Christ rebukes them, certainly they deserve some rebuke. But to me, it speaks to
the fact that we all need to consider continual growth. But also, similar to how when Christ sends people out to work, he sends them with others. He rarely sends a single person to go out all alone. And this passage speaks to why that is. It is valuable to take a wiser person with you. Because you may encounter something that if your state could not grow, you would want to deal with that. And if you have a partner in your work in the kingdom, you are more likely to have someone who with you can deal with that. Thankfully, their partner was Jesus.
Yeah.
But I think that there's lots of wisdom in, if you're going to look at, like, how did Christ treat the disciples and how did their work get done. I don't think he just sent them out in groups because it's more fun to be in groups.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And you know, there's a lot of encouragement in this because we're able to see the end result of the disciples. We constantly, throughout the gospel accounts, see their failures, lack of faith, lack of trust, who is this who's stilling the winds and the seas that we're hanging out with all this time? There's all kinds of statements like that over and again, and yet, talk about flipping a switch, you know, when you get into the book of Acts, suddenly there are no failures. And they are trained and they're ready to go. And the resurrection obviously had a lot to do with that. When they see him raised, they say, well, if there's a power to raise a man from the dead, then we've got all the power we need. And it goes from there. So really, really good. Yeah, great point. Anybody else on this section? Anything else? Yeah.
The last verse to me is so moving.
Good.
And they were all astonished at the majesty of God. So there's a recognition of what's happened here of who Jesus is and who his power is coming from. I think it just confirms what all of these healings and miracles were done to do, to confirm the message against the deliverer of that message.
Yeah, good. And in fact, if they're insightful as they should be, then they would be seeing in this that the kingdom of Satan is being crushed. It's being conquered. And this would be, and again, if they're fairly knowledgeable of the Old Testament prophets, they would see in this the prophecies coming to pass where the Messiah would come and conquer the enemies. And so that would be a picture given there. Good, good. Anyone else on this? All right. Those are the main things, I think, to cover there. Let's go on then, and the next paragraph, middle of verse 43. But while they were all marveling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men." But they did not understand this saying. And it was concealed from them so that they might not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this saying. All right, interesting little insert here. How does this connect to the previous? What do you see in this text that is unique, needs to be pointed out? Too many of you are talking all at once.
Just before that, he says, "How long should I be with you?" And here he's saying, "I'm not going to be here long." Basically, it's a short time.
Okay. All right. And he's certainly signaling to them there is an end point of this. There is a goal. Okay. Good. Somebody else. I'm looking for some people who've never talked before, you know. I might call on Sarah just a second.
I was mulling.
Yeah, you have I know you have good insights on this because I've heard you before, so go right ahead and tell us about it.
Well, it just struck me that the idea, you know, while they were marveling at everything he was doing, he said, "Let these words sink in. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men," right after he just cast out that demon. I mean, that doesn't seem right. to compute. How can he be over, you know, have the power over demons, but at the same time be taken by man?
Yeah.
That's kind of
excellent. That's a key in the text. And you see that connection. He's just been transfigured on the mountain. He comes down and casts out the biggest, baddest demon around. And then he turns around and says, by the way, it's not going to be long that they're gonna take me and they're going to take me away and just kill me and all that. And you can see them going, what? This does not compute. All right? What else in the text? Michael? Yeah? Oh, I thought you, well, you know, you're scratching your head. I'm going to. Hey, what else? Go ahead, Julie. Yes, good. And that's a great point. In fact, when, like you said, with the parable of the sower, they went into the house, they asked, they sought, and he says, to you it's given to know the mysteries of the kingdom. Why? Because you were seeking, you came in and asked. Here's a situation where they do not ask, they cannot figure out, it's concealed from them, they're not perceiving what's happening, but they don't ask. They're afraid to ask. You apply that to your Bible study? How would you apply that to your Bible study?
How many times do I read over some story or some strange passage and I'm like, there's probably something there, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
Well, let me just move on.
Yeah, I'll just move on. Yeah. Or even worse, and I'm sure we've all done this, I know I have. You read a text and you go, if that means what it says, it contradicts everything I believe. That can't be. Let me read on. Well, that's a great way to stay in error. That's a great way to not pursue the truth. That's a great way not to be impartial with what you read. Yes. If that means what I think it means I'm going to change a whole lot of my life, and that doesn't sound good either. That's right. Change is not something, especially major change, is not something we're usually real interested in. All right, so yeah, there's a lot of emphasis even at that particular point. Even though they have pursued and asked in situations before, they do not with this one. This one's a hard one to take. He's going to leave them, and that doesn't sound good.
To me, this is a section that, if you start back and call it the first half, the third of chapter 9, maybe for the next few chapters, certainly through in chapter 10, it's very valuable to read all of these together. And I think the way we're doing this, where we're looking at three or four verses, we're losing something. Because basically, these, whatever it is, 50, 60 verses are mostly examples of the disciples just being confused.
Yeah.
All these different ways that they're confused. And I think it's important to see that together. The other thing I would say is, the beginning of this section where this verse we're looking at right now, where it says they were marveling at everything he was doing, and then he says, basically, hey, like, I'm going to go die, and then they're confused. I think that's almost like a mini version of the transfiguration that we had, you know, just a couple weeks ago. They're confused. We need to build a bunch of altars, and we need to do a bunch of stuff, and Jesus is like, no, confused about who I am and why I'm here. My belief is that here, when it says that they're marveling at everything he was doing, that potentially that marveling is again focused on the problematic idea of Messiah, that they're expecting all these physical things to be cared for. And now he again is like, stop talking about all this physical stuff, stop marveling at the individual things I'm doing. I'm about to go die.
And then the very next, they again illustrate their confusion. You're talking about doing the grace.
Right.
They keep getting twisted all through here. He keeps trying to like undo that. And at this point, I feel like we don't see a lot of hope that they're going to figure out what's going on.
It's kind of like saying, have you ever had a really bad week where everything you try just goes south? That's exactly what this is. You know, they just keep running into failure here. They keep messing up and misunderstanding over and over again. And you, as you said, you see it right on through as it just keeps right on going with that. Michael?
Well, that's the beauty of the next verse is that not the beauty, the bad part about the next verse is that what do you do when you're insecure in your own failures and you have messed up a lot? Oh, I'm going to start ranking myself against everybody else around
everybody
me
else.
God,
yeah.
You know? Let me see if I'm better than them.
That's right. That's good. That's good.
I think it's hard for us to fail. Growth is good for you. See Jesus and see His work. We've really got to get it.
Yeah.
I don't think we can imagine what they were doing and the disbelief they had at times. And I think it was completely normal. I think we would all go through the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're exactly right. It's easy for us to look at it from the outside and know that this is Jesus because we have all the hindsight available to us, and then look at these guys and go, what is the matter with them? And it had to be extremely challenging, especially when you're thinking, this is just an ordinary looking 30-year-old guy. You know, he doesn't have some kind of special look to him here to cause you to go, wow, well, that's the Son of God. That's just pretty obvious, Ken.
This is backing up just a little bit, but I've always been very concerned about Matthew 17, verse 20, about faith. You have as much as a grain of mustard seed, or you can go over the mountain. So I used to worry about, when I was young, I worried about that. Okay. The only way I know to move that mountain up there is get a bulldozer or
Shovel
and start moving that. How can I do that? I know that's permanent or something like that.
Yeah.
The way he's saying that, but I still haven't figured out how I can move the mountain.
Yeah, well, and really, this obviously it is a figure of speech that he's using because Jesus isn't interested in us throwing the Himalayas down or something like that. But it is, there are mountains that must be moved all through our lives, and there are huge things that we look at and say, that's impossible, right down to personal, whether it be personal sins that may seem like mountains or people to teach or whatever it could be. There are things, trials, suffering, etc. Those are the kinds of things that overwhelm and cause Christians to fall and cause them to fail forever. You think of anybody you know that has turned away from the Lord, turned back into the world, they have a mountain in their life that they finally decided they couldn't overcome. They couldn't conquer. And they sought the source in the wrong direction and therefore failed. And just like the apostles here. Fortunately, they actually come in the house and say, what did we do wrong? You know, where did we mess up? And he explains to them the need for their growth in faith and prayer in order to truly rely upon God. And that, it always comes down to that. I think about that in my life all the time. It comes down to, am I going to trust that the giants in the land of Canaan are going to be nothing if I put trust in God? And that's it. And it doesn't have to be a mountain of faith. It has to be, I just trust Him. And I may not be a mountain of faith, but I'm putting my trust in Him, and that's key. Wayne?
I was listening to the radio, and somebody was talking about strongholds. a stronghold, even though, and I'm sure somebody would say, do we have possession like that today? And how many angels does the devil have? How is he everywhere like God's everywhere? Does he know everybody's thoughts? Well, he's got plenty of helpers. What is a stronghold today where you are letting that entity dominate?
Yeah.
What is a stronghold? How does that work?
Well, yeah, and I have to, again, I don't know all the details on how Satan works, but he does. And 1 John 4:4 says, you've overcome him because greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And the Lord just plainly stating, you have the strength to defeat him. I gave you the strength.
Every stronghold can be broken.
That's right.
It is up to that person to break it.
That's exactly right. It needs to be done. Let's go on then to the next section, verse 46. And an argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. But Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him in by his side and said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all is the one who is great. We know from all the gospel accounts put together that this is a problem with them. They don't just do this one time. They do this repeatedly because they just can't get out of their mind the way an earthly kingdom would operate, the way a typical kingdom would operate, and so they keep looking at it that way. So you notice in this text they're doing this again, and then Jesus uses the child example. So that's what I think primarily what we need to explain in the text is, how is it that this child example would defeat what they've been doing?
One reason this didn't come up this time, because just previously Peter, James, and John had gone on the cross of the mountain. Maybe this is something that just brought it back into your mind.
Yeah. I can see the argument of Peter, James, and John. We went on the mountain. He took us, not you. When the little girl was raised from the dead, he took us, not you. That's a signal to the rest of you guys. You're not going to be on the top dog like we are. And then it went down to the three of them. Which one of us? Peter goes, he told me I have the keys of the kingdom. You know, you could just imagine all of the little intricate arguments that could have come up about that. Which, of course, is a good reminder. It hasn't a bit of significance in this world as to what talents and abilities and opportunities that God is giving you that might be more than what somebody else has. That has nothing to do with greatness. Zero.
Well, these are just men.
Pardon?
I said, these are just men.
These are just men. That's right. And what did they have before Jesus came? Nothing. That's right. And that's the way, same with us. It's got nothing to do with it.
I think it's really interesting this section. I mean, obviously this idea of children having really nothing to offer and being completely dependent, right? But we also see this in this middle of this section where, like, the disciples weren't able to drive out this demon, and then later they're like, they see someone else doing it and they're trying to stop it, like, they're not one of us. Because I think that they're trying, and they're having this argument about who's greatest. They're trying to use being associated with God as a way to bring themselves, like, glory or status or greatness, and to be special, to make it about them. Like, no wonder they couldn't cast out that demon, because they were focused on themselves. And, later it talks about the cost of what
Paul's doing
actually
looks like. Right. Good analysis. Excellent.
I guess I will say from the flip side of that, in that I think it starts with their insecurity about not being able to do the things they wish they could do. And that insecurity breeds the pride that says, okay, if I can't do this, at least look at the things I do have and how I'm better than my brother here. And Jesus' way to quash that is say, like Nicole said, I mean, be humble. Have humility within yourself and realize that you receive this child like that. Who has nothing to offer you, that is how you defeat that insecurity. Because it says in verse 47, Jesus knowing the reasoning of their hearts. I think this is a lot deeper than just they're selfish, perhaps. I think it's more to do about their insecurities.
Good. And you certainly have a situation where, you know, they're grasping at anything in order to lift themselves back up out of that feeling. I just recall growing up and seeing a lot of, and see it in my immediate family, but I saw it oftentimes within some brethren who used the belief that they had the truth and then used that as a club as to demean those who did not, instead of having compassion on others and realize that if you do have the truth, then it is because God has blessed you with that in order to share it with someone else. We are not beyond that kind of thinking. It's important always to remember, how am I saved this day? By grace. That means you are nada, nothing. You are saved by His grace. What do I have? Nothing except what He's given me. I have this by His grace. Paul would repeat that over and again concerning himself, who would indeed had an argument of the greatest apostle ever. he constantly says that in that way. So it's great. Again, what are we looking at in discipleship here? We keep seeing that a different picture of what disciples ought to be. Also, as Adam pointed out, we keep seeing pictures of failures of the 12 to be what they ought to be. And so the great series of events here that corrects our thinking, and very important. Okay? Anybody else on this? Yes, sir.
Matthew 20:27. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave.
Yes.
There's so many men think they are great Christians. They're arrogant. And they don't understand what Jesus is calling them to be.
Yeah. And again, it is a thought process that thinks about what I'm able to do or what I have accomplished, I, and then that somehow is supposed to translate into I'm better than somebody else. That's exactly what these guys have done. Look at us. We're the chosen. We're above all others. We're His personal disciples. We're going to be key to the kingdom. There's all those things that would have gone through their minds, especially with some of the promises that Jesus gave them. And what you do, what you're able to do, what you accomplish has nothing to do with greatness. And that's, the world does the opposite, doesn't it? The great are the one who accomplish. The great are the ones who can do what others can't do. And it doesn't mean a thing. So it's important to remember that. Good points. Look at the next text, verse 49. John answered, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he does not follow with us." But Jesus said to him, "Do not stop him, for the one who is not against you is for you." Nicole pointed out, this is almost laughable. They've just been told, "You see this child? Hang out with children a little bit so that you realize that this is the kind of attitude that you ought to have. Hey, we saw some guy casting out demons." What's wrong with their reasoning? What'd you say, Jerry?
They're saying that he's not one of us.
Yeah, he's not. First reasoning is he isn't sitting on the inside circle here. You know, we're the chosen ones. What does he think he's doing? There's a competition going on. What does he think he's doing, taking away from our glory? You know, we're the ones that's supposed to be casting out demons around here. And what's he doing? What else is wrong with their reasoning? That's right. What was Jesus' argument about casting out demons and about Beelzebub? The devil's not going to cast out the devil. So if they're able to actually literally cast out demons, which there's no doubt that they were from the text, they're on God's side. Just because I chose the 12 doesn't mean there's a whole bunch of others I may have been talking to and giving power to when you guys were sleeping. You have no idea. What's going on, Jerry?
For verse 48, a few versions say great, a few versions say greatest that I've seen. It's almost as though they're like, well, at least if we're not the greatest, we're all great.
Yeah.
We're the great ones, and then the other people are not.
We're greater than that guy over there, for obvious.
Because we have a group as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, side note, it is interesting that many in the broader religious world will use this text to try to prove that, all religions are equally the same and you should never say there's something wrong with something else or some other religion or belief system. Obviously, there isn't a blooming thing in this text that would indicate that. In fact, if God or Christ has given the power to cast out demons to this particular individual, it would only be because he stands with him. They are going down the same road. They're in agreement on what they're teaching. You're not going to have the power to do this miraculous if you are teaching something that Satan would approve of, that would be contrary to the gospel of Christ. So that part alone is silly. So again, does this kind of competition sometimes happen among Christians? Absolutely. You see this. Sometimes you see somebody who sees they have a particular talent that is maybe different or better, quote unquote, than somebody else's, and then they condemn others because you don't do what I do. I do my talent, you do your talent, and I'm not good at your talent, you're right. But that isn't a reason of condemnation or cast somebody out. Or there's competition. That happens a lot with preachers, competition. I have a lot of competition with Shane Scott, you know. I just go, I give up, Shane, you're the best preacher. That's all there is to it. And I talk to guys all the time who will say, I wish I could preach like that. And I say, yeah, I do too. But I can't preach like that, so I just preach like this. So there you go. Can you imagine Amos saying to Hosea, I wish I could do what you just did. You know, you were so loving. I'm nasty when I talk to these guys. You can just see that God's like, I'm using everybody in different ways. And that's, again, it comes back to that humility. It comes back to that service that we are to give. Okay, so very good. Hey, please grab your colored pencils this week. Really go into the text, mark it, be ready to give observations that you see from the text.